First, right away and before dawn, Yankele has to leave town, because clearly the Shabbos goy has a fixation with him. And secondly, to appease his resentment and to protect the town from peril, we have to give the goy a raise, a larger portion of challah and a double portion of brandy, and maybe he'll have compassion.
Welcome to Season 2 of The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. Today, we'll be reading The Shabbos Goy by Yitzchak Leibush Peretz. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
It's a true pleasure to begin this second series of Stories Jews Tell, welcoming back its subscribers and greeting those who are joining us for the first time. Well, because some of the best-known Jewish stories are associated with the fool's town of Chelm, this is where I will begin today, though I have to warn you that the literary work that I'll be treating here is not like the Chelm stories you may have heard as children or read to your own children. Its citizens confront questions like these: which is more important, the sun or the moon? After much controversy, the rabbis of Chelm decide that the moon is the more important because whereas the sun shines by day when it is light, the moon shines when it is needed, by night when it is dark. Well, this is the kind of logic that would delight a child who cannot yet distinguish cause from effect. We should note that our comical version of Chelm bears no known relation to the historical Polish city of Chelm that lies 40 miles southeast of Lublin, whose Jewish population dates from the 15th century and numbered some 15,000 in 1939. Historical Chelm lay on the international trade route from the Black Sea to the Baltic Sea, a source of economic benefit in peacetime and of liability in times of war. Our legendary town of Chelm acquired its reputation when God gave an angel two sacks of souls, one foolish and one clever, to be distributed equally all over the world. But the sack of foolish souls snagged on a mountaintop over Chelm, so there they landed, which is how the sages of Chelm came to amuse us with their wisdom. Now, many modern Jewish writers saw in the rabbis of Chelm a wonderful vehicle for their various literary projects. Some created their own fictional Jewish towns instead, like Sholem Aleichem's Kasrilivke, the town of cheerful paupers, which we featured in our earlier series of stories. A story situated in Chelm raises expectations of laughter. And our story today, by the Yiddish writer Yud Lamed Peretz, I.L. Peretz, called The Shabbos Goy, here in the translation by Etta Bloom, opens with just such cheerful expectation. The rabbi of Chelm, in ragged fur cap and tattered satin robe, a tiny Jew with a prominent Adam's apple and laughing gray eyes and a shriveled face, between one Talmudic problem and the next, he cheerfully gets up, surveys with confidence the open Gemara through glasses on the tip of his nose, and as his rightful share of worldly pleasures, takes up the wooden snuffbox. Aye, gotten you, dear God, what a sweet world you have created, he praises the Creator. What splendid creatures walk about in your dear world, Jews, and, to be exact, others. Aye, people made of gold, of velvet, of satin. Peretz's rabbi of Chelm, just as we might have anticipated, indulges in nothing stronger than a pinch of snuff, and thinks the world is made up of lovely people. But the serenity of this story is interrupted. Suddenly, into the study house runs a man shouting, Rebbe, help! His mouth is bloodied, and of course the rabbi recognizes him, as he knows all his parishioners. What happened to you, Yankele? He asks. Who did this to you? Oi, oi! The Shabbos Goy, Rebbe. The rabbi of Chelm stares in amazement. In the middle of the week, Yankele? How do you come to the Shabbos Goy? Now, as the term implies, The Shabbos Goy was an employee of the Jewish community. Since Judaism prohibits certain types of work on the Sabbath, some of which are nonetheless necessary for safety, a non-Jewish individual was hired in advance within certain rabbinic guidelines to do things forbidden to Jews, like putting out lamps or lighting stoves in the winter. The great Jewish scholar Jacob Katz called his book on the subject The Shabbos Goy, a study in halachic flexibility. And several prominent Americans, including Colin Powell and Elvis Presley, boasted of having done this service for their Jewish neighbors. But the term and the concept were bound to cause discomfort to modern Jews, first, because it involves a never-easy arrangement between the Jewish community and the surrounding Gentiles, and second, because this is just the kind of legal loophole, Katz calls it flexibility, that moderns tend to think hypocritical. No doubt, Peretz already intended his title to set readers a little on edge. To explain his bloodied mouth, Yankele cries that he was walking in the marketplace, worried about not having money to bring home to his wife, when along comes the Shabbos Goy with a bag of pumpkin seeds, tossing them into his mouth and spitting out the shells. When he sees Yankele, he says to him, friendly-like, "Here, Yankele, open your mouth." Yankele expects to be treated, but instead he gets a hard punch in the mouth. "Oy, the murderer!" he wails in pain. At this, the rabbi of Chelm objects. "You do not call one of God's creatures a murderer," he says. "But Rebbe," moans Yankele, showing the rabbi where his teeth have been knocked out. The rabbi studies Yankele's bleeding mouth, is flabbergasted by what he sees, and ponders two questions at once. How does a Jew come to have such large, strong teeth? And what impels the Shabbos Goy to want to knock them out? Together, the two questions give him the answer. The fault, Yankele, really belongs to your teeth. He explains that the Goy may not be completely innocent. By nature, he is an amiable creature, so he really did ask you to open your mouth, wanting to treat you with that little favor. But when he saw his fine teeth in your mouth, he naturally got excited. And what does a Goy do? He strikes out with his fist. Go home, rinse out with a mouthwash of figs, and from now on, don't show a Goy more than a crack. A Goy doesn't have to see that a Jew, wonder of wonders, has such teeth. So Yankele goes off, instructed never to open his mouth more than a crack, and the rabbi goes back to his books, his snuff, and his amiable view of the world. Before the month has passed, however, Yankele reappears, this time bleeding from the head. He reports that as he was walking home, the Shabbos Goy hit him hard on the head from behind, grabbed the loaf of bread he was carrying under his arm, and bit off half right then and there. The rabbi commiserates and wishes that the community could compensate Yankele for his loss, but he absolutely objects to Yankele's calling his assailant a murderer, a rotzeach. There are no murderers. The guilt, I tell you, lies in the bread. In the holy books it is written, a man sins because of bread. Putting his arm around Yankele, the rabbi patiently explains how the tradition warns against Jews who transgress the commandment, "Thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not kill." How much more so the Gentile who sees a Jew carrying a loaf of bread. The rabbi instructs Yankele the next time he carries bread home from the market to hide it under his coat. In folk tales, things happen in threes, so before very long, Yankele turns up again, badly bruised. The rabbi subjects him to a thorough questioning because it's beyond comprehension that in the course of a single season, a Jew should get beaten up by the Shabbos Goy three times. Yankele assures the rabbi that he was neither carrying bread nor showing his teeth, but rather trying to escape the wrath of his wife by running to the mikveh, the bathhouse, on the outskirts of town. And sure enough, the rabbi once again has the explanation. I tell you, Yankele, in the rear of the bathhouse must be the place where Cain, as it says in the Holy Torah, killed his brother Abel. It is a particularly dangerous spot for Noahites, who cannot by nature control themselves. Determined that the place itself simply exerts its evil influence, the rabbi intends to prevent such incidents in the future by warning his parishioners not to venture to the back of the bathhouse, and in fact, to consider moving the mikveh from there to the center of town. But when Yankele turns up bloodied a fourth time, even the rabbi has to admit that something has to be done. This time the Shabbos Goy attacked him near the synagogue, which is in the center of town. This represents danger indeed, because on Yom Kippur, when the Goy comes into the synagogue to light the candles before the final prayer, he could destroy all of Chelm. So the rabbi calls an emergency meeting, summoning all the notables of the city, and Yankele tells them the whole story. The community turns to the rabbi for advice, and he does not keep them in suspense. He tells them, first, right away and before dawn, Yankele has to leave town, because clearly the Shabbos Goy has a fixation with him. And secondly, to appease his resentment and to protect the town from peril, we have to give the Goy a raise, a larger portion of challah and a double portion of brandy, and maybe he'll have compassion. The end. That is the end of the story, except that Peretz adds a coda in his own voice. You're laughing? Still, there's a little of the rabbi of Chelm in each of us. Well, what do we have here? Is this a Chelm story? Well, isn't it? After all, it makes fun of innocence and foolishness taken to extremes. There's a basic distinction between laughing at and laughing with, and the traditional humor of Chelm is definitely of the first variety, inviting us to enjoy the mockery of improbably silly adults. You remember that when the Jews of Chelm need more room to build houses, they decide to push the nearby mountain farther away. As the sun rises and the day heats up, they take off their jackets, and a thief runs off with the jackets. When the sun sets, they are pleased to see how far they had pushed the mountain. Why, they can't even see their jackets anymore. As if the premise of pushing the mountain were not ridiculous enough to begin with, they misconstrue the theft to support their idiocy. Now, Peretz writes in the same idiom, likewise laughing at the rabbi of Chelm, but he adds the ingredient of rishis, of evil. Suppose that the thief in that classic Chelm story had not merely taken the jackets, but burned down the town while the Jews were pushing the mountain, and ravaged the families they left behind. Introduce danger to the vulnerable community, and the comedy darkens. Right from the start, the rabbi seemed to take too much delight in his snuffbox. His eyes brighten, his heart gladdens, he strolls about the house of study almost dancing as he gives praise to the Creator, suggesting that his pleasure is less in God's law than in his snuff. From the way the rabbi refers to Jews and others, people made of gold, of velvet, of satin, we realize that he knows nothing of the people around him. Ignorance is not innocence in Peretz. The decisive departure from Chelm comedy is Yankele's bloodied entrance into the story. A cartoon character like the caged little Tweety Bird in the Looney Tunes series is funny only as long as we know that Sylvester the cat will never eat him. Short-sighted Mr. Magoo is comical only as long as no one pushes him over a cliff to his death. The benign humor of Chelm depends on a manageable world. The introduction of violence challenges the premise of innocence. Peretz's Rabbi of Chelm bears a strong literary resemblance to Dr. Pangloss in Voltaire's Candide, who famously believes that this is the best of all possible worlds, and whose worldview doesn't allow for the presence of evil. If everything in existence, including natural disasters, is meant to suit a preordained and positive purpose, then it is perfectly logical to justify the Shabbos Goy's aggression by some pre-existing flaw in the Jew. Yankel's call for help would require addressing the Gentiles' unprovoked hostility. But the Chelmite is ideologically opposed to the reality of evil. The rabbi must therefore persuade the victim that he is to blame for the violence against him. Thus, what begins as innocence is seen to be evasion, distortion, and finally, collusion with aggression. As the evil escalates, so too does the urgency to deny it. The rabbi is finally forced to expel Yankele as the ostensible cause of the Shabbos Goy's violence. This, in a nutshell, is why some liberals, like Chelmites, shrink away from confronting the war against the Jews, or war in general. One additional note on Peretz's choice of a Shabbos Goy as the story's aggressor. The Shabbos Goy was a beneficiary of the community. In then-current Marxist thinking, bosses and employers abused their poor workers, yet here, the employee of the Jewish community enjoys threatening and brutalizing the boss, knowing that he can get away with anything. These Jews let their employee become their exploiter. While most Foolstown stories are universally enjoyable, this one was not intended for Polish, Russian, or Ukrainian readers. It is a national story, aimed at the Jews specifically. They are the ones being laughed at for being victims not only of the surrounding Gentiles, but of their own dangerous sweetness. This story appeared during what one critic has called the radical period of Peretz's writing in the 1890s, the decade of rising Jewish political engagement. When yeshiva students left the study house and saw the first Jew get his teeth knocked out, actually or metaphorically, since anti-Semitism was becoming a feature of the surrounding nationalist movements, some said it was because Jews wore a kapote instead of dressing like the others, or because they spoke Yiddish instead of the languages of the land, or because Jewish factory owners exploited their workers, because wherever they lived, Jews occupied other people's land. When Peretz here exposes this instinct to appease by justifying anti-Jewish aggression, he included himself in the censure. There's a little of the Rabbi of Chelm in each of us. Being a minority by choice, we will always be tempted to act this way. In a recent issue of Mosaic, the Young Tikva scholar Tamara Behrens called this a story we can't do without, which is just what I felt the moment I came across it decades ago. And now that you too are familiar with the story, I think that you may notice how often it comes to mind. If you'd like more Peretz stories, you can find a wide assortment in my edition of the I.L. Peretz Reader. But next week, we will be reading Yosef Chaim Brenner's story, Nerves, about the beginning of Jewish resettlement in the land of Israel. For now, happy reading.